this process is contained in the web magic. The question was?
The letter K.
What do you mean?
As opposed to the letter T.
And we've also got a question about
prayer and personal contact with the Godhead, which implies rather a misunderstanding of Godhead. When we have personal contact, it is with God, rather than the Godhead. God is the personalized Godhead, and Godhead is the impersonal source of God.
We'll deal with it as far as we can
in drawing. Also, the formation of habitual behavior and the
mechanics of the nervous system.
As we are not aware of what parts of the nervous system have been developed in the right way, we want an indication of some technique so that we integrate the right kind of ideas and remove the others. We're going to deal first with this
K
and T. We've said that the M means substance, that A, really R,
is energy.
The two together mean appetite,
whence your mother is so called,
and hard G means the earth itself,
that's a symbol of the earth.
The I is the point of application, and the K is a force striking an obstacle. So we have an appetite, a gross concreting of the appetite in a precise situation
by
the application of a force. In the letter T,
the idea is not of a
force applied against an obstacle, but of one force passing another. So in this form of the T, this is the Tau cross, the statement is that this force can't get higher than this point because this higher force
stops it
penetrating. Similar, if we take the curve of a wheel, abstract a part of the metallic here in one radius as a force, there's a centrifugal action from the center pressing out.
The spoke
can't fly out because the rim is holding it in. So in this form of the T,
a force
superior is going past, really derived from a curve,
and this is a radial force
which can't go beyond it. In the case of the K, we have an obstacle with a force applied to it. And in the word magic, we have to take the Ma, the appetite,
cause it to rotate,
and solidify by compaction, and then to drive the will,
which is the letter V, turn on the side,
to drive the will onto the situation. Now you can then turn the K up this way.
That is the earth line.
Shade it in and call it hard gay. Now the appetite is down here, and he's trying to work up. We have to, by the force of the will, apply it
from a particular point and cause it
to concrete itself by deliberately driving in.
And we can't do this unless we have
the duality. One side is the will side, the other side is the idea.
We cannot drive on
to a point unless we have a certain amount of power plus a certain amount of form.
The form is to control the power.
The power is to energize the form. So the more we can bring the will into the idea,
and the idea into the will,
closer and closer, the more near we are to the magical process, where the will,
becoming coincident with the idea,
must materialize. Now most people have this sort of process going. There's the will line and there's the idea. And their urge is operating through the body, and there's a mental process operating in the mind, and they've really got nothing to do with each other at all. They never interfere. The thinking process of an untrained man has no effect whatever upon his will. And because this is a psychological fact in most people, psychologists who made statistical surveys of it
have come to the belief
that the truth about man's behavior is to be expressed in what they call psychophysical parallelism. This head side represents your body.
This idea
side represents your psyche. And in psychophysical parallelism, the body and urges are acting, and the idea stream is flowing, but they have nothing to do with each other. One cannot interfere with the other. The urge goes on and has no effect on the ideas. The ideas go on and have no effect on the will. And we know that this is a fact for most actions. If we take the organic actions in the body, say digesting food, we know they go on, regardless of what an average man thinks. But we also know that this does not apply in certain emotional states, because every idea has a feeling tone, and that feeling tone can produce an emotional strain such that it acts back into the organic side, and an idea with its feeling tone can induce a failure of digestive processes. So there is a possibility through the mediation of the emotions whereby an idea can interfere with the will. But those psychologists who believe in psychophysical parallelism, in their own experience, they found nothing whatever when they looked inside themselves to lead them to believe that there is any power in the idea to influence the course of life. Now, if magic is to be a possibility, we can't have this parallelism. We can't afford an idea stream that doesn't interfere with the life behavior pattern. So we have to bring them together, cause this convergence. So when we look for a will, we find an urge in the body. If we try to find out what the urge is aiming at, we have to start thinking, clarifying it. And initially there's a distance between the will and the idea, such that when the idea tries to interfere with that urge, take a primary urge like hunger or sex, when it tries to interfere, it has no effect on it, whatever. You can easily devise very simple experiments to show that primary urges don't take much notice of what we call reason. And yet, if they don't, we've got a parallelism which cannot lead to the change of the world in conformity with our will and idea. So we have to define the will, and in the act of defining what it's really going at, we are taking energy from the will and putting it over into the idea, and we are empowering the idea. When we start clarifying the will, we have to cut the will. You know, in the Egyptian myths, Osiris is cut to pieces by a wicked demon and has to be put together again by his mother, the moon, and his son, Horus, the hierarchical concept. We must have an idea of a hierarchy of powers, and on the basis analyze the will. We then play the will energy into the idea, and the next impulse of idea and will has less distance between it. And every time we analyze the will, we reduce the distance between will and idea. We'll try and make an example of this in a moment. If we persist in the process of analysis, we can drive the will until finally it meets the idea and they coalesce. The idea is then seen to be the form of the will. In this one, the process of concreting an idea is the same as the process by which the universe is created. We start off with a field. That field, in order to create, must arc. Suddenly should invent me a robot. When creation is to come, it means that the forces that were uncircumscribed must be circumscribed. Now, in experience, you will find that if you think about any given thing or person, you will get an immediate feeling reaction that you either feel inclined towards them or not. This is a vague feeling. I don't like that fellow much. You haven't bothered to define it, but there is a definite feeling orientation. And the moment you can say that there is a movement towards or away from a being, it means that you have started to spin your feeling into forming. Before that time, it was unformulated. There was no circumscription. The moment you begin to like or dislike, you've really begun to define a situation. Now, if you leave it in that state, like the man that didn't like Dr. Fell, then you cannot create. You can't complete the process. Now, in the magical process, you have an appetite, and it has to be driven into a definition, and progressively sharpened by the action of idea upon it, until you drive it into the center, the Saturnine impression, and you make it so hard and compacted there, it won't go in any farther, and you're still driving, and there's your K, and here's your energy of the will on it. You're hitting into this definition until it gets so hard it suddenly breaks. And at the moment it breaks, there's a shine out of light through the whole process again, and you suddenly realize what the vague feeling was that you had before analysis. First you have this undetermined feeling. You try to find out what it is. It appears as a vague liking or disliking. You insist on analyzing the situation until eventually you come down to a formal fact. And then you hit that formal fact and carry the analysis right to the limit, and suddenly the fact breaks. And that flashes the light right through the whole process. And the result is understanding of the reason why this vague feeling was there. I shall draw a man now, and you will see whether you like this man or not. I have a vague feeling about this man to begin with. Is this particular man worthy of your attention? If you look at it, you will find some kind of feeling. Now, we have to do this and look at it and say to ourselves, what do we feel when we go around here? Is that all right? Nice egg shape, that pleasant. When we see this sharp corner, go in here. Let your feeling run along and change direction. And then let it switch up the nose here. See what happens when you get this nice egg on this switch. See what happens with the feeling. And then this angle dropping down here, which is really vectored up, and this one curling up, and then this lip here, vectored down. Now you've got a different feeling here from here. Every line in a work of art, like this wonderful Michelangelo-esque creature, and every line in nature is a force plus a direction. If I make that very, very strong, I can increase the force without altering the direction. So I've got a direction plus a force, a vector quantity there, and my feeling arises from the direction and the force added to the direction. So I get a flip up in that way, and then another one down here. There's a slight elevation on the corners of the mouth, which is associated with some possibility of humour. There's a withdrawal backwards here of the jaw, which I'll use in the function of this jaw, where the skeleton is done, the jaw itself is like that and hinges here, that if he opened it, it would drop down here. You see? All these things, as you look at them and analyze them, become clearer to you why you like or dislike that person. If I draw another man here and I give him another kind of nose, put a very sharp line over the nostril in that manner, turn the mouth down and put a nice strong line down the side of the nose, put out the bottom lip, let the eye slope down, put the eyebrow high. This is the sort of person from which you derive a feeling that it is a being who considers himself in certain ways superior. You see this flight back of this line, and then this one is going down, you see, and this swinging up is closing the nose. There's a certain race that have a very, very strong line around the nose there, and it means they don't want to smell you at all because you're an inferior being. The mouth is turned down and compressed. That means the appetite center doesn't want anything to do with you either. So altogether, such a face suggests that you are not a very valuable person. And as you analyze the forms, so it becomes clear to you why this vague feeling really meant what it meant. So we have the form, the actual shape that we see, and the fact that the consciousness, in order to follow it, must move. And the character of the motion in the feeling is the significance of the form. And if we only look at it vaguely and don't analyze verbally the directions of the forms in relation to each other, we will not understand this feeling. Here is a vague feeling, and there is another vague feeling. And we add something anthropomorphic onto it, and we add something anthropomorphic onto this. As soon as we do this, we immediately find the character of the feeling is beginning to alter. And the greater width across the bottom here suggests female form, and over the shoulders the male, and immediately we tend to be orientated towards it because of this formal fact. So if you actually saw a silhouette, that shape, against the light and nothing else, and one this shape, and you were in a certain condition physiologically, you would tend to follow this one rather than this one, even from the point of view of a very, very simple silhouette seen in the distance. The form has certain associations at least as old as the human race, and actually considerably older. You know, we have a force vectored down and a force vectored up. This one is based on heaven, power. This one is based on matter. So this two-interlaced triangle symbol is female and male. And to meditate upon the relation of those two is to generate certain feelings inside yourself. This is the purpose of yantra meditation, where you take such a form and move along it. See what you feel like on the different angles. This one will give you a totally different feeling from this one. They are very, very simple forms, generic forms, from which the forms of human beings, animals, plants and so on are derived. These forms predate humanity. They occur as primary vibrations in the substance before individual men are made. So they are associated in the depths of consciousness with primary experiences. So we have a very good method then in the magical process of avoiding the psychophysical parallelism, where we have a stream of ideas and a stream of life urges ignoring each other, by taking the impulse and asking ourselves in words, what is this impulse? What is this impulse trying to do? And that will then give you a general direction. The impulse is always going in a given direction to do a particular thing. So when you ask yourself, what is the direction of that impulse, the form goes in and brings the will and the idea closer together. The impulse will then appear to change its character somewhat. From a vague direction, it becomes more specific. And you must then proceed again to analyze and make the thing more specific. You find a general thing, say the sexual urge, would appear as a very, very general movement towards anything of the opposite sex. Then if you say, what is the precise nature of this urge, and set before it various shapes, long, short, fat, thin, and so on, as you contemplate the different forms, you will find that the will becomes more specific. If you say, all right, supposing this is a male, and this is a female, and this one is going to analyze why it is attracted towards this one. First of all, there's the general shape, it is wider across the pelvis. Then, it becomes apparent that that isn't quite enough, it must have something else. And there begins a definition, where we'd like it to be rather a long triangle as opposed to a very short one like this. Now, this depends on racial experience. If you belong to a tall type physiologically, then your memory images will be largely biased to sharpen themselves in idea towards the shape. And if towards a short race, they're biased towards this shape. And by simply asking yourself what particulars produce more or less response, you say long hair, short hair, curly hair, straight hair, black hair, fair hair, and so on, big feet, little feet, whatever it is, you're driving the will to clarify itself, which is the same thing as causing the will to become idea, and the idea to become empowered. Now, we know that when the primary undefined will begins to spin in, at the precise point where it completes a circumscription, it then deserves the name idea. Because now we have a division between inside and out. But that idea, in order to become a material fact, has to be driven in. And we can only drive it in by defining the nature of the will in terms of its idea, the clarification of the direction of the will. So as we're driving in the will to the center, we're clarifying the idea. And what we are driving in is will, and it is that driven in will which becomes idea. So when the process is entirely completed, there is an exact coincidence of will and idea. You've gone beyond the dualism. In that case, you are not a parallelist. At that moment, when you do it, you can interfere with your life process. Now, a very good exercise is to take your hand, look at the shape of it, and see that the fingers separate out from the palm. That is the idea, the visual image, the form. And feel inside your hand what it means as feeling to do that. You feel that you can separate the fingers and move them independently. You see that they are independent. The feeling has generated the separateness of the fingers. Every new growth comes out of a bud. There's an egg and it buds. And it grows itself a brain by budding like a tree does. And it grows itself arms. A little bud comes on first and prolongs. Then five little buds come on the end of that. And all the time the feeling to differentiate is pressing out. The feeling, which is at first vague, produces a vague form. And then it gets a bud. And then it starts pushing through that, finer and finer, differentiating all the time. And this differentiating process, at the subtle level, is idea. But as you're packing in the material from food, it becomes a gross body. And there is nothing in the gross body that is formed that does not precede the gross world and is formulated by the feeling. So if you feel in a certain way biased towards or away from something and you eat food during that feeling, the feeling will carry that food and certain elements in it which will resonate with that kind of feeling, and it will deposit in your physical body and change the constitution of the body. So if you get a food, say we'll take a cow and live on grass and so on in the field, and turns that same material that it eats into bones and tendons and muscles and nerve fibers and brain substance and so on, all out of one diet, it differentiates this substance of its food in many different ways. And the thing that does that differentiation is a feeling which itself has this urge from its source to move always towards greater diversity coincident with harmonizing its diversity. There's more diversity in a man than there is in an amoeba. That means there's more spiritual energy in him. Spirit always grows, and as it grows it splits. And it's always trying to differentiate all the time. This is the origin of the letter V. And nevertheless, it's a bounding line. Every tree has a bounding shape. The shape of a fir tree, and the shape of an oak tree, wondering about what it is, and so on, is a product of the psyche. This is generated. So the form we actually see in the world is no more than the concreting of something that pre-existed vaguely in the field, and was simply sharpened up, becoming idea by compression, by the will applying itself to define. Now, in this one, we have the question about building this into the nervous system so that we get the ideas we want and not the ideas we don't want. The question is, how do we know when we don't know what we have already knit, what we should knit next? And the answer is, you don't know particularly what you should do at all, but you do know generally and universally. The thing is not to try to interfere with the particular nervous knitting, because you couldn't do it. The nervous system knitting is already far too complex. So what you have to do is get your universal propositions right and allow those to infiltrate. Your nervous system is a structure something like a tree with nerves coming out all over the body. You cannot be expected to know the terminus of every nerve in your body. But in your head here, you have a center in the forebrain. And if you put your governing concept and leave it there, just keep restating it, that governing concept will release energies in accordance with association law down the nervous system and cause the synaptic resistances to vary in the light of this governing concept. So we do not have to sort out the particular synaptic resistances, the knitting of the nervous system, as it is in particular. What we have to do is get the universal proposition right, and that itself will go through the nervous system and sort it out. This concept is the leaven. The leaven is the whole loaf. The whole loaf is the whole body. So, we restate it. Every being is circumscribed. Every circumscription excludes the absolute in including the relative, excludes the infinite in including the finite, and therefore every circumscription is a limitation if you put your consciousness inside it. But is a created entity something gained if you put your consciousness outside? So there are two ways of looking at the material fact. One is that everything that exists, circumscribed, is a real limitation on the being inside, because when he tries to push out, he finds a limiting factor. Thus, if I think that my physical body is myself, I must feel imprisoned within it. I can't communicate with you at all, other than my funny sounds. I have first of all to construct something, an idea that you exist, then I have to rattle my tongue and hope that your eardrums will rattle and that some sort of interpretative process will go on inside you. And that is an assumption if I am only the body. In fact, it isn't anything like that. A child does not believe in the physical body as separate when it is born. A child has no concept whatever of separateness in the physical body, and it thinks that all the world is obeying its needs, because when it feels hungry and makes a noise, it's fed. So it doesn't distinguish initially between its own impulse and want and the mother that supplies the want. It's only later on that it learns to distinguish between its own body and the body of its mother. He pulls his mother's nose and ears and wonders why it can't feel the pain and why that being, which previously he did not think separate, suddenly interferes without volition from the child. So it's only the fact of a will outside the child imposing upon the child that convinces the child that there is an external being at all. So, to get rid of erroneous integrations, false ideas, we do not spend our time with the particulars. We spend our time with the universal. And we say all beings are circumscribed, and this really means all beings. The physical body, this house, the earth, the solar system, everything within it, all circumscribed, therefore finited. With two views, one from inside, it is a limiting factor. The other from outside, it is a gained point. The solar system is a limiting factor if we consider ourselves within it. But if we consider from infinity, it is a gained thing, a created entity. It's only a shift of the attention to become, instead of miserable, identified inside and trapped, to shift the consciousness outside and say, I, the true I, this one that looks the absolute I, have made the universe. It is only a shift of identification. The fact of circumscription remains the same. Now, in every circumscribed zone, there is an active and a passive. The active is always the one who is aware of the absolute consciousness, and the passive is always the one who is not aware of it. And there are degrees of awareness. So if a person is aware that there is a force coming from outside the earth causing the seasons on the earth, he's not surprised if a plant starts springing up in the spring, because he knows that they're dependent on certain solar forces to spring. Another person who did not know that and had no idea of the relation between the sun and its angle, its ascension, and the heat given to seeds in the ground, that person with reference to a pillar of stone which was copying a tree. The big fact of the wheeling of the sky, something was turning, either the sky or the earth. And those who had very clear logic said it isn't very likely that the big one will be turning and the little one not. It's more likely that the little one will be turning and the big one not, relatively. So they then taught the people that the earth didn't move, it was the centre. There was everything up there and didn't move. And this made people materialistic, geocentric, and tied down their imagination to the earth. When they tied it down, then the astrologer priest kings studied the movement of the stars. They have a clock in the sky for the year, and they know exactly when the Nile is going to flood or it's time for the seeds to start coming up. Then they wave the magic wand and say, I will now make them come up. And all the materialistic earthbound people with the false concept are amazed at the things that occur when these prophet priest kings say it is going to occur. So always from the universal idea, the power comes. And that power infiltrates through the nervous system. Thus, if you once clearly put in your mind that in any situation whatever, there is an active and a passive, and you make a decision, I would rather be active or passive, consciously, then spontaneously in the nervous system, without you knowing where initially, there will occur a change. The synaptic resistances will vary, and quite suddenly you will find yourself superior to a situation which previously dominated you, because now you have become clear that every finite being is trying to be active or passive in a given situation for some end. The will always works to an end, and every being, every finite, is trying to be active or passive. Now, if the other fellow is weaker, it will try to assume the active role in relation to this passive one. And if the other fellow is stronger, it will pretend to be passive rather than get a good hiding. And that on the physical, the emotional, or the rational levels. So as you become conscious that in any situation you must be either active or passive, there is no middle between, or being active or passive, you must be so rationally, emotively, or volitionally, and you make yourself clear about this, and you don't bother about any particular applications, you are doing the work that Christ says here. Put your mind on the seed of the kingdom. Seek first the kingdom and all things will be added to you down here. There is the kingdom. And then he says, do not take any thought about what you shall say before you go before the judges, because it will be given to you in that moment, providing you have not rehearsed the particulars. What you do is so engrand the universal upon you that in every particular situation you see only the universal. Then in any given situation, without rehearsing, you've already got a measuring stick. And this measuring stick is that the situation is circumscribed. There's a limit to the power that can be applied. Some being is going to be active and some passive. You evaluate your own strength in the situation and decide whether for the moment you're going to be passive and walk out from the Queen's audience backwards, or whether you're going to be active and sneeze on the carpet. Isn't it? Whatever you do, it must be a conscious decision if you are going to cause this convergence of will and idea. Now, there's a question here about the personal relation, prayer and personal contact. It says here with the Godhead. But the Godhead we don't draw anything for. But the big circle then which there is no larger is God. And we said before that as a worshipper we must have this God as an object for worship. But it is an object for worship. The Godhead is the paper. It goes right under the God and into the worshipper. And if the worshipper had not got in him something of this white paper, this absolute consciousness, it could not become aware of the possibility of a larger being than itself. The largest being that there is, which is God. Now, prayer to God means the reduction of the external interference. Here is God's body, that's the biggest circle there is, and here are finite beings, which are simply rotations like this of this cosmic energy. Each being is exactly the same as this being qualitatively, but not in dimensions, not in power. This is identical with this, but this is circumscribed. So the difference between this and this is qualitatively nothing, but in dimension, this is small. And therefore the amount of power available to it at that level is less than there is for this. And furthermore, these can mobilize themselves and cause interference. This interference is what we mean by the external sense world material. And we cannot get into contact with this big God unless we cut down that interference. That is, if you try to pray, prayer means a rational work, the affirmation of this big wheel that runs right through the lot. If you try to pray and at the same time you get a friend of yours to hit you with a large piece of bamboo on the ear every 2 seconds, you'll find that the process of prayer is interfered with. In the same way, any external stimulus whatever, hitting one of your 5 senses, turns the attention into the realm of external physical stimulus, and thereby lowers your vibration. Now the God vibrates at a certain pressure. You remember we drew that in the middle of the letter Aleph. The absolute there is the Aleph. And here is this first circumscription of the God, right on the bar, and we said this was the hay pressure, the pressure of the first circumscribed spirit. To pray to God is simply to cut out the interferences of a lower order. And you remember what we said about them? We had the other, that's the absolute, that's equivalent to transcending the God concept and going straight into the Godhead. Then the hay, which is the personal God, and then the chet, which is a tough man on earth, sort of Napoleonic figure, then an intellectual working for him, and then a funny fellow who talks out of the back of his head. These are the stages of vibration. The sexually determined impulse, that can interfere with you. The intellectual impulse can interfere with you. The will to power as an individual can interfere with you. And if you cut out those 3 interferences, the sexual interference, the intellectual interference, and the will to power over other beings as finite, then there remains this very fine frequency of God in you, and you are then in contact. That frequency is there all the time, but it gets obscured by these other frequencies superimposed on it. Now, as we grow older in life, we pass through these various phases. At puberty, the chief stimulus is a court stimulus, a sexual one, so that it's very, very hard, practically impossible, for a boy going through the phase of puberty to meditate at all upon God as a proposition. Because these impulses are now dominant. They're coming through and disturbing his consciousness. After a time, they will die down and he will go to the university and become an intellectual. And then the energies for a time will manifest in strange talk, largely about the fundamental principle of the first thing. And then you will find that certain of the boys sort themselves out. And some of them that are very strong, with a terrific will to dominate the others, the hetmen, define these other students as mere intellectuals. Now that is a very dangerous state to be in, where a person has the power and could dominate and could by will define these thinkers as mere intellectuals and the others as naughty boys wasting their substance instead of studying the real subject of life, namely power over other beings. So it's harder to conquer the will to power over other beings than it is to conquer your intellect. And it's harder to conquer your intellect than it is to conquer the sexual impulse when it is dormant. Because the thing about the sexual impulse is that it dies down immediately after satisfaction. And you can then make statements about freedom from it and give it up and all sorts of funny things. So it appears in its absence that that's very easy to control. But the mind is not absent so often. Perhaps only during sleep in most people. So to stop the intellectual processes of the mind requires more energy. But to stop the individual will to power over other individuals requires a terrific amount of energy. And you can't adequately pray to God unless you stop those three. It just won't go there. Because it's a matter of frequency. If you really think this God can help you, you're talking about the universal being, and that universal being already has all the other beings under its control. So for you, as an individual, to think of dictating to other beings from outside and ignoring the universal is just a product of ignorance. Nevertheless, that is very, very strongly rooted, the will to power over other individuals. If you can conquer it, then it follows that universal consciousness is yours. If you then give up even the idea that you need a God to help you, you then pass into the absolute consciousness, where you quite suddenly realize that your consciousness and the universal were identical, and that that was logically presupposed in the possibility of a relation. Because two beings cannot be related unless there is something identical in them. And that thing identical in man and the universal God is spirit. Christ says, God is spirit. In the Bible they put a spirit. But there's no a in the original. In the Greek they haven't got the indefinite article. And the proper translation is God is spirit. Not a spirit. If you say a, an Occidental thinker tends to think it means one spirit. But one spirit is circumscribed, whereas spirit is not circumscribed. God is spirit, and that spirit blows where it lives. It goes inside the universe and out. It blows in this manner, it goes out. And the individual has no control over it. It blows where it lives. Like an elevator hitter, and then suddenly let go. It has a purpose. And once the purpose is fulfilled, it lets go of the individual vehicle. So if the man was in a state of identification with the work done in that, like Napoleon, you say, if he attributed his success to himself as an individual, then he would be profoundly upset when later on the force removes itself and he has to face the fact that he has no power. So Napoleon on St. Helena, brooding, cannot account for the desertion of himself by what he considered to be his own genius. So the way to get at the other pressure is necessarily through the hay pressure. because we have to go by overcoming the sexual, the intellective, and then the will to individual power to accept the universal power as a fact before we can get to the Aleph, which is the absolute. And therefore, this universal one, which is the cosmic Christ, is the one that said, no man, that's one of these little circles, comes to the Father, the absolute, except through me, the cosmic universal. So if we do not become aware that there is a universal, we cannot become aware that there is transcendent spirit, the Godhead, beyond the universal. Now this big universe is the cosmic Christ. He's sitting, this is his seat, at the right hand of God the Father. The right hand means power, the left hand means form, or will and idea. He's sitting at the right hand because the right hand is the executive hand of power. And all the power of the Father comes to individuals within the universe through the massive cosmic sphere. So no individual man in the universe as an existent gets power other than immediately through the massive cosmic being. So he has to climb back through all those stages, through the massive cosmic being, to get back to the absolute source of spirit. Is that fairly clear?
I think that's true.
That if we deal with the nervous system, we must not try to deal with particulars. Because we cannot possibly know what particulars require attention. Just as in vocabulary, if you take one word out and falsify it, you falsify the whole vocabulary. If you take one physical habit and decide that that is an enemy and stop it, you have no idea of the changes that must occur in the nervous system in order to balance it. In a diagram where we make the six going through their centers to make a seventh. The statement is, every being is interlaced with these six forces, and to step up one of them forces the other five into compensating activity. Each one must defend itself because all are eternal. Therefore, if you try to interfere with any particular habit as a particular from the outside, you will cause counterbalancing activities in the rest of the organism. You'll have more to attend to than you did before. The same thing happens in certain kinds of medical treatment where a symptom, an isolated symptom, is attacked by a drug that is known to cause that symptom to disappear. Now, it hasn't caused the cause of the symptom to disappear. It has caused that symptom to regress, and the energy that was then appearing spreads through the body and appears as other symptoms. The first disease is then said to be cured, and the patient has something else. And this is simply the balancing factor, that if you stress one, you beat it, the reverberation goes through the whole being and alters the relation of all the parts. So we go back to this principle that only if we've got the macrocosmic concept that we are all living inside one being, which being is God, that one being sends its ripples through all beings, so there is no individual being inside here that hasn't got as its ground cosmic intelligence, which means every human being has got cosmic intelligence underneath it. And if it weren't for the interference of beings, stimulation of one being by another, then every being would have cosmic consciousness. But simply because beings do in fact interfere with each other, they fabricate funny devices like ITV, especially to do so, therefore there is an obscuration, an extra vibration goes on top and covers up that other vibration, the cosmic one, which is still there, and makes it be as if it were not. So that most people with a materialistic training actually do not believe that their bodies are shot right through with cosmic frequencies of intelligences higher than their own. And because they don't believe it, they're entirely subjected to them. Because if you don't believe in the existence of a being higher than yourself, and that being exists, that being is acting upon you without you knowing about it, which means that you're really being passive to a universal force. So we get a statement like, the crown is in the north, a mystical statement, and the south has fallen asleep with the heat. And those people who don't understand what that means are subject to that law. If they carry the consciousness low in the body, and the lower parts of the body are hotter than the head part, then their awareness will fall asleep. And a man is like a mineral world, and a vegetable world, and an animal world, and a man world. If he carries his consciousness down in the belly land, really he's a kind of vegetable. And his reactions will be of the vegetative order. And the vegetables only move towards and away from things in a very simple, rudimentary manner. The animals have a slightly more complex way of reacting, and men have an even more complex way because of the increase of ideation in them. And there is the integration process of the whole, which is called the human, the man who is aware of the field or the cosmic being. And at each level, the man who believes that that level exists begins to operate from it. So it is sufficient for you initially to believe in the possibility of something for a flow of energy to start to concrete it. This is the magical process. This is why Christ says, when you pray, pray believing, and believe that you have received already. You believe, and you start a process. If I ask for something, I don't think I may get it next week. I think the moment I ask for it, immediately the universe changes, because I have asked. And at that moment, the first flow starts. If my next thought is, oh, perhaps I made a mistake, it stops. And I have stopped it. Because my thought is formulating it. It is opening doors for it, and letting it in. And if I say, I'm not really sure that the universal exists, I shut the door again, and it can't get through. Every idea is a formulation. Every formulation is a block on something, and these blocks are of relative strength. A universal idea is a big door, and inside it we have lots of little particular doors. The difference between one man and another is the number of doors and the thickness of those doors that he has. Good, yes, buffer ideas is the same thing. A concept is a door, and at the same time, a block to another concept. So, in praying to the God, the universal being, which is identical with the cosmic Christ, we have to cut off the external interference and know that we have cut off, this is fairly easy in later life, not easy at puberty, cut off the sexual impulse, cut off the intellective impulse, and then cut off the will to power as an individual, which is not very easy. It's harder than the other two. The will to power, the will to demonstrate power, the will to do anything as an individual over others. When that is cut off, then you will find that there always was the God consciousness, the cosmic consciousness, underneath these things, under the sexual, under the intellective, and then the individual will to power is always the cosmic impulse vibrating, waiting for you to stop the interference. So God is represented as knocking here. Behold, I stand at the door and knock, says the cosmic Christ. Now you have to open the door. If any man will open, I will come in and sup with him, he says. But if you won't open, and he won't constrain you to, because you have to have free will in this matter, then you won't get it. So if you believe, you open a door. And immediately, not later, not next week, immediately the flow starts. And when it begins to come in, if a friend comes to you and says, what are you doing? And you say, I'm having faith, he hits you with a stick of his idea. And he says, faith, what's that? Good gracious. Close the door and get on with something. Now that external stimulus might set up an idea in you that maybe that was wrong. And at that moment you close your door and the flow stops. So there is a real fight going on in the world. And there are two categories of beings. Those that are trying to get faith and those that are trying to stop them getting faith. Those that are trying to get the faith are actually called the elect. That is the true meaning of the word Jew, not to be confused with the word Yiddish or Judaism and so on. Jew is that man who is getting this and knows that this is the ultimate and that his real fight is to stop this interference. But all those beings that are materialistically based have as their expressed aim the reduction of every being that tries to get to spirit back to the horizontal, back to the grindstone, back to work, and so on. All the materialistically based beings have it as their life aim to reduce every other being to the material level. So we can say immediately that all Marxists, and today that means many millions, all Marxists are enemies of spirit. Actually, they say the word is nonsense. They say it has no meaning. There is only matter and its modalities. And if a man were to say, I have faith, straight away, one of these materialists would say, faith is rubbish. It's a fabrication of wicked churchmen. The faith isn't rubbish. Faith is that amount of white paper inside the circle which enables you to know that there is some more white paper outside the circle waiting to send a message, if you will stop the external interference on the physical body. Now, is that fairly clear? Any specific questions? Let's remember our old glyph for a taxism. There's the force going along, and here's another force representing the reaction of being. This letter X is the Andrew cross and symbolizes the action, the whirling action that occurs in an organism when the stimulus hits it. And we have two kinds, either plus or minus, if you remember. Those are our taxisms. A positive one towards the stimulus source and a negative one away from the stimulus source. And there are no other possibilities for us. We're either moving towards or away from a stimulus situation at any moment. In fact, if a person has a negative taxism, they're being driven away by the stimulus. Suppose we get a certain person, and that person is furnished with a funny kind of pattern like this in the mind. And there's a nice ear, there's an innocent person waiting to hear a profound truth. And here is a symbol. And that symbol is mentioned and it stimulates the ear, goes inside, and does that. Now, it doesn't fit the internal pattern anyway. So if that person is identified with that pattern, and this is strongly stated, that person will find that the energy put in through the ear will go in there, can't be assimilated, and it'll go down there to the legs, and it'll pick the legs up, and it'll go out. It is bound to do so. If the idea, the universal idea, the big idea, is presented forcefully, it will actually contract the muscles of the legs of that person and walk them away. And this no being can stop, not even a human being. The idea will determine. So your only defense against universal truth is to assimilate it. Otherwise it will push you about. If you assimilate it, then it cannot disturb you. If we have a man whose idea is so clearly put inside there, the presentation of this one inside there just goes over it like that, all he does is says, yes, I know that. But if he can't say, I know that, then the disparity between the two ideas produces a psychological state called despair, with the result that there's a release of energy and some motor activity to go away. Now, every idea, we said, was the center of a generative field. There's a field around every idea. The idea is the form, the shape. And round it is a field, and it is called the feeling tone. The feeling tone. Every idea, whatever, has a feeling tone. But every idea you have is complex, and therefore it's made up of a feeling tone which is complex. But there are only two feelings, liking and disliking, and therefore its complexity is just that there are a number of likings of a certain intensity and a number of dislikings of a certain intensity wrapped up into a ball. So you have to break down this idea in order to cut it until finally you can get yes and no out of it. The feeling tone produces a release. Supposing here is a man. There's his rational part, there's his feeling tone part, and there's the motor part in the head. He gets an idea. That produces a feeling in him. We'll say there's plus and minus. And if the idea stimulates plus, I like it, I'd like to add it to me, energy is released down the spinal nerves to the arms to appropriate the thing. But if it goes into the negative side, it will move down to take the hand away. I'm not having it. And what determines whether it goes to the right or the left to take or to withdraw is the character of the control concept in the mind. That's tremendously important. If you get your control concept firmly fixed in the mind, it will condition your whole liking and disliking pattern and will release energy itself to take or to withdraw, to say yes or no. And therefore that control concept, which is the symbol of the cosmic Christ, is understood, which will save, solve, wash away all these faulty patterns. That rubbishy pattern in that brain is in everybody's brain. All the time, there's a chaotic impulse. Over it, you can superimpose, and by concentration, you can set up that master concept in the head until it determines activity. When it does, it will sort out the nervous system. When it does, it will guarantee that any prayer and contact with the universal is substantiated, made real, and produces results. Without it, man is not man at all. That is the sign that makes man man. Remember, the first being that appeared on earth, who was better than an animal, invented the wheel. He invented the lever. Part spoke of the wheel. He invented fire, two wheels rubbing together, making fire by friction. He invented geometry. He invented the curb, whereby he controlled the rest of the beings. When Adam is commanded to dominate all the animals on earth, it is this concept that he is given. So man is only really man when he understands that concept. Out of it has come the wheel, the lever, the two greatest inventions, fire, geometry, logos. Everything that makes a man has come out of the application of that symbol. You can then understand why that symbol is so tremendously important to Plato and Pythagoras and other ancients who were really thinkers. To set this up in the mind and to understand the real relation, to see that the moment you take that vertical arc and put it on the diagonal, a conflict occurs. Why so? Because now it is not decided which one is active and which is passive. Unless you can assert the dominion quickly between yourself and the situation, the whirling cross, the Andrew cross, appears in the relation. Supposing there's a boss at work and he has some workers. If he can keep their confidence that he's a man of his word and strong, not to be fooled about with, they get on with their work on this plane. But if he forgets that for a moment and comes off his active watchfulness and inclines straight away. They will incline too. Then comes insubordination. So the Andrew Cross is an automatic appearance the moment the George Cross gets out of equilibrium. So it tells you that in your relation with other beings, if you want to avoid a conflict, be quite sure whether you are active or passive in the situation. If there's an interview and you're being interviewed by the Pope or something on his territory in the Vatican, say to yourself, I am the passive one here, and he is the active one. And I, as passive, am merely receiving the bounty. There's the bounty coming on. And receive as much as you can. Now, if he comes to dinner to you later, because you are such a pious, passive believer, then you have to stand up and supply the dinner and determine the course of events, and he has to accept what you give him for dinner. But you must be very clear about your role in any given situation, because where you are not clear, the Andrew Cross will appear, and there will be conflict, and it will not be resolved until this George Cross is put up again. Get used to it, use the symbol, put it in your mind, engrave it there, and know that once it's really engraved, it will operate. It doesn't need help from the individual end, from the gross material end. That cannot help. The gross material is dead and itself passive to the processes of spirit. And therefore, it cannot help you, but that concept can help you. That concept, which has been passed down from the macrocosmic self, from God, passed down to a long line of traditions until we receive it. If we set it up in our minds, will always tell us exactly what to do. Because we look around quickly, we avoid the parallelism, we evaluate the power of that man and the formal situation, we draw them together into a point, and decide how much power and how much idea we have in this situation. So in the Vatican there's lots and lots of power ranges on one side, and ideas, traditional costumes embodying ideas, and a lot of people ready for any crazy people that might have ideas. And if you know that, then you play the passive role. And in every other situation the same. So engram this on the mind, that this sign is saving. Remember Constantine, the first emperor to be converted to Christianity, on seeing the sign of the cross, said to himself, in this sign, conquest. The form of it that these traditionalists first have seen is this one. The whirling cross, the Andrew, which is the Greek letter P, and this sign like a P, which is the Greek letter Rho. So it represents Ki Rho, the first two letters of Christ. That is what tradition says it means. But it doesn't mean any such thing. What it really means is that there will be a fight wherever there is a phallic power. And wherever there are people, there is a phallic power. And the man who can turn that cross like that is the man that can incline the phallic energy. You actually find this Rho P here as a phallic symbol, drawn as a determinant in certain manuscripts of action, direction of people. So we can turn this cross, the Andrew cross, by studying the inclinations of the phallic energies in the environment. We know that the man who is at the chet level, who has the desire individually to dictate to others, is being driven by phallic energy. He is the father, he is Peter. And he's going to be Peter too, he's going to be the first pope. And if he has that inclination, he has a concept in his mind that he's one of those. Therefore, if there comes from outside, rattling his eardrums, this way for further power, he must respond. So that the concept that he has inside must react to the nature of the stimulus from outside. Now this gives you the indication of in what manner you have to work on your own conscience. Clearly understand the nature of this circumscription, active, passive, that the refusal to set up the active and passive clearly in relation results in the appearance of the conflict whirling cross, and then watch all situations that you get into and deliberately verbalize, saying who is being active, who is being passive at the moment, and at what level, physically, in the urge level, emotionally, rationally, and talk to yourself in that way until you get an organ of thought working for you continuously. The other fellow will not know what you're doing. So if he's one of those who's trying to dominate the situation, he can't tell what's going inside you, because the will to dominate is an individuated, hard will, and very, very insensitive. So he cannot possibly become aware of your internal processes. So he actually becomes progressively more and more passive to you, as he is determined to become more and more active to you. Any particular questions? We've got 5 more minutes. Have we got any particular?
When you were speaking about Napoleon, that he'd lost his power, had he fallen into the same position as Samson, that he could become attached to the player of his own will?
Yes.
And when that happens to him, does he lose the advantage of the experience that he's had during his period of power? Is he breaking up his own experience?
Well, he's already disintegrating if he makes that error. You see, it's the same with a symptom of a disease. It isn't the cause of the disease. You cannot get it unless already you have committed some act which has unbalanced you. The symptom is only evidence of a previous unbalance. That Napoleon decided to crown his son before his son had shown anything whatever meant that he'd abandoned his original position. When he carried his field marshal's baton on his knapsack to begin with, he was talking about individual internal drive to get somewhere. When he crowns his son, who hasn't gone out of babyhood, he's abandoned his initial position of individual effort. So already he's corrupted himself, and that is merely the evidence.
The other one I want to talk to you about is when you're talking about these three different forces that you have to deal with, such as sex, intellect, and the power to dominate, are they the levels that go to Ra and the miracles? And is the fellow that is on the resonance with God on the me up at the top, that's what's happened to you when you've got
the
resonance with God, is it?
Yes, yes.
And those three
are
the
three that are below, in fact. Yes, that's right. The Ra is a chet one. The Ra is the... It's a chet one, that will to dominate.
That's right, yeah.
So you have to add mercy to that, don't you?
That's right.
In order to get over it. Mm. Because the fact is that as you increase in understanding, and as that concept becomes more fixed, you cannot help increasing your power to dominate, and therefore you're in danger if you identify with the power that you have. So you have to use mercy and not dominate when you could. Otherwise you will be tricked. And you will start that process where the energies released by you must bounce back off the universe and hit it.
The other one that I wanted to ask you is that when you are superimposing these universal concepts onto your mind, are you actually killing off these other ideas, or are they just going into their place?
They're going into their own place. You do not destroy anything, you merely apportion proper places to each thing. Nothing is destroyed, but everything goes into its own place.
So if your top concept is
wrong
is one, you're completely
governed by
that.
Oh yes.
The whole existence.
Why do the instructions in this world, speak of the praying, Why do they appear to be so much stronger than the universe? Can all relate?
Well, because of this reason. Every created being is a power that has contracted in order to create itself. So there's a drift into the centre of power from the absolute. And once it's gone into the centre, it must express itself. So that from the individual point of view, the natural flow of energy is to extrovert. You see, in the Indian terms, the horses of the senses are dragging your chariot. The natural thing when a child opens its eyes is to be fascinated by the light that hits it. The energy is outflowing. If there weren't an outflowing of attention, there would be no perception. So necessarily in the evolution of the human being, from the stage of childhood up to maturity, it must flow outwards. Otherwise it's not going to get the experience. And that outward flow is that which brings it into contact with the interference. But when it can turn back from the zone of interference, it has gained reflexive self-consciousness.
Does the word interference mean burning?
Burning?
Fear and fire.
Yes. Well, the root of it is to do, fakere, and fair means energy, this valley process. Interference means where one action is lapping over another, or where two fires as causes of action are penetrating each other. It's going on all the time. If you went into a room, soundproof, on your own, and said, now I am free from interference, and became very, very quiet, you'd find that you are not free from interference, that the room is vibrating, that the floor vibrates. Actually, in a totally dark room, if you open your eyes, you'll begin to get sensations of light. There is interference. If there's furniture in the room, you'll begin to see it. Because everything is moving, and as you become progressively more sensitive, so you are becoming aware, you're seeing at a different level. There is no absolute darkness, because wherever there is motion, there is the potential of sense stimulation. And you know, if you just press on the eye a little bit, you see a light. But the eye closes, and you press on it, you'll find lights appearing. So the eye interprets every stimulus as a visual one, the ear as an audio one, and so on. So the essential character of the stimulus, namely motion applied, is interpreted in five different ways by five sense organs, specialized. So in that isolated room, you begin to smell things. And furthermore, the memory of everything you've ever seen would start playing itself out to the level of hallucination. The thing that stops hallucination and fantasy in ordinary people is the impression of the outer world hitting them. So when they wake up in the morning, the orderly process of the external world saves them from their internal fantasy for the time being.
What is the definition of mercy? I think an attribute that can only be shown by someone who has already reached a very high level of integration. It means nothing to someone on a low level, does it?
Now, you cannot be merciful unless you have power superior to the person on whom you're going to exercise mercy. And the meaning of it is, you take the mare, which is the sea, the ocean, the bitter ocean, and that mare is a glyph, the MR function, the Rome function, of the domination by the material situation. And mercy shows you a way out of the situation. That's the sea, then. And a possibility after the escape of remaining integrated. That's the wire at the end. So mercy simply means that power which lifts you out of a situation which would have been perfectly mechanical as far as you are concerned. It lifts you out of it and lets you integrate. So it's removed you from a dangerous mechanical situation, put you into a free state, and allowed you to integrate. Hence the quality of mercy is not strained. The straining is in the mesh, the stress strain of existence. And to take you out is to release you from the whole mechanics of the situation. And it is called mercy because the person lifted out didn't deserve it. It isn't merit on his part. that he's just lifted out by somebody already outside. Hence, unless there is somebody outside, there is no mercy. Now, we know that there is mercy absolute, because the absolute cannot be circumscribed. And therefore, we know there is absolute mercy. It will lift us ultimately right out of the macrocosmic field in consciousness, out of the machinery of existence. I must depart someone.